Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Will Summerlin. This is part two of an interview I'm doing right now with him. Part one was completely fantastic. We talked about Tesla's full self-driving program, real-world AI, how to look at companies that will be taking advantage of AI in the future, how they'll apply it. And it was just an awesome conversation. And I wanted to focus actually part two of this interview on kind of a more different angle. I want to look at some companies that might be benefiting outside of, let's say, Tesla and autonomous driving. But I want to ask Will about Palantir. I want to ask Will about genomics. I want to ask Will about different sectors that we might need to be looking out for in the future of AI, so we can kind of have an advantage, a better grasp of understanding where this whole field or the world is headed in 5 or 10 years. So anyways, welcome back, Will, to part two. Appreciate your time. Awesome.
Excited to be here.
Yeah, yeah. In the break, we were just mentioning how all this stuff is so fun. I could talk about this stuff every day, all day, just because the magnitude of what's happening with AI and technology is so radical. It isn't like a small incremental change. It's fundamentally completely redefining, how technology is rolling out, but how our lives will be impacted in the future. And yet the future is largely unknown in terms of the exact, details, the picture itself, but we know the direction, right? And the pieces are there. And I think understanding some of the core kind of, things about AI and what it's doing is it makes it just so fascinating, because it seems like we're in, as you're saying, one of the craziest times in history in terms of the amount of change and the pace of change. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is this will go down in history as one of the most important transformations that humans have ever been through. And I think in part one, I talked about, this is on parallel with the agrarian revolution, when humans went from hunters and gatherers to farmers. And it's of the same order of magnitude as the Industrial Revolution, when humans moved to city centers and started, becoming more efficient at manufacturing and everything else. And I think in many ways, this will be bigger than both of those. It's going to completely fundamentally transform the way we exist on Earth as humans. It's going to change the way that we work. It's going to change the way that we live. And I think a lot of people underestimate the impact of AI and the impact it's going to have on us and the impact it's going to have on society overall.
Yeah. You mentioned in part one, and also done some tweets on this on OpenAI's GPT-3. And for those who aren't aware, OpenAI is a company that was actually co-founded by Elon, even though they had, it seemed like, some type of fallout, but currently led by Sam Altman, previously of Y Combinator. But OpenAI has, developed a model, GPT-3. They've taken, billions and billions of words, writings from the internet, combine them into a model, and they're able to create articles and text on the fly on any topic. And, it's very convincing. This stuff is sometimes it's hard to know if a computer has written this, or most of the time it's whoa, this is a great writer, And it kind of has shocked a lot of, people, observers, in terms of what a big jump, it's made. What are your thoughts on OpenAI's GPT-3, its significance, and where is this headed? Are we headed in a world where interacting with a computer is going to be indistinguishable with a human? And if so, what's the time frame?
So there's an interesting issue that came out, or article that came out a while ago. Somebody, a researcher, had actually created a blog post using GPT-3. So GPT-3 generated an entire blog post off of a prompt, and he put it on a website called Hacker News. And it actually got ranked up, bumped up, voted up to the number one post on there for about 24 hours. I think that's a great demonstration of how believable GPT-3 can be to human readers. And it was kind of just gibberish. It was rambling about, stuff that was not totally coherent, but it was coherent enough for people to think that it was a human. And I think that that was kind of indicative of what GPT-3 is capable of. And I've played around with the API. The other day I was playing around with it and actually generating recipes. So I would go in and I would say, hey, I want to make a pizza, and I have chicken and tomato sauce and mozzarella. And it would generate a recipe and say, hey, here's, put your oven at 350 and put the pizza in and add the cheese and add the sauce and bake the chicken on the stove and all of that. And what's really incredible about GPT-3, just to kind of back up a little bit, there are other models that can create a recipe, but they're specially designed and trained for that specific task. They're trained to be recipe generators. Now, GPT-3, on the other hand, can create a recipe, or it can write a poem, or it can take some complex academic text and summarize it in a way that a second grader can understand, or it can make jokes, it can have conversations with you. And it wasn't necessarily trained, it wasn't designed from the beginning to be great at any of these one specific tasks. Rather, it was trained to be a general language model. It was modeled to be sort of the computer equivalent of a human when it comes to language. So as humans, we can also generate recipes, but we can also have conversations. We can also make jokes. We can write poems. And it was designed to be this general language model from the ground up that with just a few examples, in some cases, no examples at all, can learn how to do a specific task. And so that's what's really incredible is that if you think about the breadth of use cases here, if you feed it a few examples of what a recipe is, then all of a sudden it can start generating recipes for paella and do these incredible things. If you teach it what a poem is with a few tasks, it can start writing poems. And so I think that that's really the thing that's fundamentally most exciting about GPT-3. And I will say it's not perfect. It's still, you can still, in most cases, detect that it's a computer, not a human. But I'd say that's getting better. And if you look at sort of the progress from GPT-2 or from the previous language models, it's leaps and bounds ahead. And now I think we're going to see, GPT-4, 5, GPT-N. And I think in the near future, it will be as good or in many cases better than humans at many of these language tasks.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any, what's the word or the rumors on the fallout? Like, what do you know why Elon Musk left OpenAI?
I don't know. It's interesting. OpenAI went through a transformation. It was started as a nonprofit, and the idea was to build safe general artificial intelligence. It changed, and it actually became a for-profit company. And so they ended up reorganizing. Sam Altman left Y Combinator, which was a great post and one that many people would be envious to have, left to take over OpenAI, and they raised capital and basically positioned the company as a commercial company. And so now they're building these models, and the idea is they're going to build general artificial intelligence that's kind of the computer equivalent of a human brain, but in many cases far more capable than the human brain. And I think with GPT-3, they've already started to commercialize it. So there are over 300 applications, commercial applications, that are already using GPT-3 to do things from translation to chatbots to grammar correction. And they're actually startups now. It's funny. I saw there are a number of startups that have actually gotten seed or Series A funding where their products are built entirely around GPT-3. And so there's one company that does like grammar correction. There's another company that builds chatbots. And they've actually built entire companies on the GPT-3 platform, which is exciting. But I don't know what the specifics of the fallout were.
Yeah, it seems like OpenAI, it seems like they're restricting access. They're being very picky to which companies have access to their APIs, because I've tried several times to try to get access, and it seems like they're really choosing the companies. I would imagine if they had an open API, really, like, you would have hundreds of thousands of companies and people, using their stuff. But which poses a problem, I think, which is, on one side, I think they realize there's danger or there's some risks at hand, because so for those who are kind of new to the AI space, you have this whole Turing test, which is a test where, can an AI or computer, either write or speak or whatever, do it in a way where it's indistinguishable, where a human onlooker cannot distinguish between the computer and the human. And it seems like OpenAI's GPT-3 was a big step toward that, becoming indistinguishable in terms of writing. And it's general, as you're saying, its general scope was the shocking part. It wasn't just a tiny thing. It was like you could do so many different things. And then when you combine this with, this whole polarization of society and just this onslaught of media and with a purpose. I wouldn't say, it's hard to call everything manipulation, but it's like you have this combination of the message with a purpose, and now you have this increase of technology where you can't distinguish now between a human writer and a computer writer. And then you have now the whole deep fake thing with videos now. So you have videos where you can't distinguish if this is like a real video or computer generated video, if Tom Cruise is speaking or not or whatever, right? It's like crazy. And yeah. So it's like there's this like kind of a chaos that some of this stuff, it feels like, is unleashing. What are your thoughts? Like, is this something society's going to figure out how to navigate, or is there going to be some, you know, growing pains along the way?
Yeah, well, I think with GPT-3 specifically, yeah, I think part of the access restriction was, I don't know if you remember Microsoft's bot, I think it was called Tay, it started tweeting things that it shouldn't have, because the public trained it, right? They basically built the model such that it would have conversations with people, and that would train and inform the model, and so people started training it and to say things that it shouldn't say, and that became a big PR disaster. I think OpenAI is a little bit concerned that the same thing would happen if they opened it up broadly. But to your point, to the bigger issue here, yeah, I completely agree. I think that AI, like any new technology, has positives and it has negatives. And I think that the positives are very clear. That's something that we've talked about, that a lot of people talk about. But I think the negatives are real as well. I think there certainly is an opportunity for misuse and for abuse of these types of technologies. If you think about just a very simple way you can exploit GPT-3, you could run mass phishing campaigns. And so if you want to, send emails or send texts to people and try to convince them that you're their bank or you're the Social Security agency, you could probably run very efficiently phishing scams at scale using something like GPT-3. And I think that that's a real concern. The challenge here is that AI adapts quickly, and it adapts very effectively. And so if you try to stop that with a traditional rule-based trust and safety system, AI is going to figure that out, and it's going to adapt very quickly. And so the only way you can combat the bad AI applications is with good applications of AI. And we're starting to see this within the context of cybersecurity. So in cybersecurity, just to give one kind of very specific example, the way that malware systems used to work was you would basically, a human researcher would look at a malware system, a piece of malware software, and they would basically create a signature for that malware. And they would push that signature out to all of the malware, all the computers running their malware system, so McAfee or Norton or any of those companies. And then if your computer would basically do a scan and say, oh, I see some software with the same signature, it's probably malware. What happened next was malware started adapting. And so it would basically change enough that it had a different signature, very, very frequently. So every time it was deployed, it would change a little bit. So it was impossible to use the signature detection method. And so the only way to stop it was to use more of like an AI or machine learning based approach, where instead of just looking for signatures, you're looking at the, what the thing is trying to do, right? If you have a piece of software on your computer that's trying to read all your files and access your email and get, access to your network, that's probably suspicious. And you could probably flag that and say, hey, we think this is potentially malware. And so we started to see, kind of early applications of AI, of machine learning within that context. And now what's happening is there are nation states, four nation states who are literally at war with each other on the internet using sort of cyber espionage and cyber warfare. And they're using AI models to try to attack companies, networks, and systems. And what they're doing is using AI to basically try to find any hole, any gap within a system, within a network or within a technology stack that they can exploit. And there are large countries and very sophisticated sort of hacking organizations that are doing this right now, like today. And the only way to combat that's with AI. The only way to combat that is to basically build a dome around all of your networks and systems and use AI to try to figure out what behavior, what users are nefarious and what are good. And so, I think that we're probably going to see something similar here, which is going back to the context of social social implications of AI and you know the possibility or the challenges on social networks of trying to trying to filter out the good from the bad. I think AI is certainly going to play a role there, and quite frankly, it's the only way to do it. You can't do it any other way.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about, you know, the role of AI in terms of nation states and the future of just even what's going on. It feels like there's a shift of power where before it was like physical weapons, you know, was the power. And then there seems to be a shift where, you know, there's always like a shift to technology and, you know, being more effective, less humans on the field, et cetera. But then now there seems to be this shift where, you know, cyber warfare is becoming, you know, more increasingly, you know, something that can be so destructive. Like you could, I mean, maybe you can explain some of this stuff, but it seems like for me, it's like, if you really have the capabilities, AI capabilities to, and you use them in full force as like, you know, one of the top nation states against another nation state, it seems like you can almost like completely cripple them for like decades or something, like take down like their grid, take down their companies, take down their exchanges, take down their, you know, government networks, take down like all sorts of stuff where it's like, I don't know how life can function because societies are so dependent on technology, on networks, on, you know, the internet. And it seems like this field of AI, it's like, and it seems we're still in the early ages, but when you look at what's happening with AI and cyber warfare and what you're talking about with technology or with security, you know, it's like, it seems like the writing's on the wall. Like this stuff is just going to explode in the next, you know, decades. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it certainly is. And you know, before I was at Arc, I was at Lyft. And before that I was building a cybersecurity startup. We were applying AI to cybersecurity problems. So spent a you know, number of years trying to think about these issues. And along the way, you know, met a number of you know, retired, you know, officials within US and kind of ally governments and intelligence agencies. And I think the people, just from that perspective, people don't understand the sort of magnitude or the complexity and sophistication of the cyber warfare game that's being played right now. Every single day, there is a cyber war going on between all of the powerful nations in the world. And really, they're doing that to accomplish two things. One is information extraction. And so, you know, this is trying to understand IP. You know, it's attacking companies within a country to try to, you know, understand what they're building and try to copy that. It's trying to extract information about, you know, military programs and understand what weapon systems are like or you know, what information they have, you know, trying to develop, you know, extract information to use blackmail and traditional espionage campaigns. But then it's also the other side of it, which is like trying to essentially put in, you know, put in a sort of a cyber bomb within systems. And so if you can imagine, you know, companies are trying to put a Trojan horse inside of power grids, or I'm sorry, countries are trying to put Trojan horses inside of their enemy's power grids so that at any point they could basically turn the switch and shut off their power grids. And this is happening every single day. And the challenge here is you have a lot of legacy systems and a lot of legacy technology that wasn't designed to sort of deal with the level of cyber threats that we're facing now. And so, you know, new technology is certainly helping and it's important. And I think that COVID was actually a really powerful accelerant here. And so, you know, companies sort of designed their security paradigm around the idea that everybody would come into an office, people would be on a secure computer in that office, they would plug into a physical network, and they had a badge access card for everybody coming in and out. And they were using sort of an old security paradigm, old network security paradigm to secure their systems in that world. And hackers knew that, and hackers were exploiting that appropriately. And what happened with COVID is everybody, you know, the security paradigm changed because all of a sudden you didn't have your employees coming into a physical office. You didn't have them plugging into a network. You had them working remotely from their, you know, from Starbucks Wi-Fi on their laptop. And they're still accessing your servers. They're still accessing really sensitive information. But you have to assume that, you know, you basically have to assume that everybody's a hacker until they prove otherwise. And that's being done through sort of a new paradigm called zero trust. It was actually pioneered by Google a number of years ago. And that's a much more sophisticated, much more capable sort of security paradigm than what existed just 2 years ago with the sort of traditional perimeter model. And that really, at the heart of that is AI and machine learning that looks at a bunch of different variables to say, hey, is this person a hacker or is this a genuine authorized user? Looking at things like the location, looking at your signatures on their device, looking at behavioral biometrics to see how fast they're typing, how they're moving their mouse. Very, very sophisticated. And you know, whereas 2 years ago, if you asked a CISO at a big bank or any power company what they thought about zero trust and their security paradigm, they would say, oh yeah, that's something we'll think about in 5 or 10 or 15 years. And you know, if you ask them today, and I've had a number of conversations in the last few months, if you ask them today, they would say, yeah, we're already along the way. We're already, you know, our 80% of our staff has moved over to a zero trust model. And I think that's going to continue. And so COVID was actually a very powerful accelerant towards this new security paradigm and towards the adoption of AI in the context of cybersecurity.
Yeah, it sounds a bit, the zero trust model sounds a bit like your previous startup, Pin.ai, where you were trying to use, I saw one of your pitches back in the day when you first launched, I think on Facebook or the internet, but basically, you know, people can go into a store, just type in their PIN and then just pay for a product without even taking out anything. I guess, yeah, it was just like the PIN, and you would use the behavioral, you know, metrics and whole host of different factors to identify, you know, the person. It seems like that idea is being, you know, it's definitely propagating in different forms, you know.
Yeah, so I'll give you kind of the two minutes on fun story there. So when we started, that was the idea. We said, hey, it would be great if you could walk into a coffee shop and pay for something without taking your phone out of your pocket. And we built that, and it turns out nobody wanted that. That was a terrible idea. But we did realize that we had built some really interesting technology when it came to sort of identifying individuals using facial recognition and using behavioral analytics. And we started talking to larger banks and healthcare companies and realized that that was a problem that they had. And basically what they told us was, hey, you know, our users are using passwords and usernames, and that's not going to change for a long period of time. But you know, they're with phishing campaigns, with all the other, you know, types of social engineering attacks, they're not secure. It's not working. And 82% of data breaches at the time were because of a stolen or guest password. And so it was a really, really big pain point. So we basically, back in, this was in 2015, 2016, we pivoted and ended up building an enterprise software platform. And basically what we did was went to you know, large enterprises, banks, healthcare companies, government agencies, and we basically embedded software behind their login and signup flow, and looked at things like how fast a user was typing, how they were moving their mouse, how they were holding their phone, you know, how hard they were pressing on the screen. And from that, we could basically detect two things. We could say, hey, if we've seen this user before, what's the chance, what's the probability it's the same user? And the second thing we could say is, hey, you know, is this some behavior that we think is anomalous and likely, you know, likely predictive of a bot or of some type of attack? And it was really interesting. And it actually dates all the way back to World War II. So back in World War II, Allied soldiers were using telegrams to send each other messages using Morse code. And they actually started to pick up on signatures between the two. They could say, hey, you know, we know that sender A types their, you know, types what a little bit faster than sender B. And based on that, they could actually do mutual authentication. And so this idea dates all the way back to World War II, but now we're seeing it become more pervasive and seeing it being kind of deployed across the enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Yeah, it reminds me a little bit about Lemonade Insurance, where they're claiming like during the sign-up process, they're taking like, you know, just hundreds or thousands of different points of information of user behavior, interaction behavior, to come up with some type of model of risk. They haven't detailed exactly, you know, what they're doing in terms of their models. Like, it's hard to understand completely, but it seems definitely, I mean, it's interesting. With AI security, I'm curious, are there any top kind of companies you think that are kind of stand out in the security world that are really using AI, that aren't falling behind, but are really at the cutting edge of, you know, implementing AI techniques to, you know, ensure security?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think there's sort of three categories of companies. There are the old world cybersecurity companies, the the McAfees and the Dortons of the world, who I haven't seen really adapt very well. There's a middle ground of companies who are old companies who are kind of transforming into new world companies. Palo Alto Networks is a good example. You know, Nikesh has done a great job with M&A and acquisitions there, and basically just acquiring the best of breed new companies and kind of using their distribution platform to monetize that. And then there are all the kind of new companies, the new age companies who are building from the ground up to be AI companies, AI first companies. There are a lot of great companies that are still in private markets. CrowdStrike is a well-known company in the public markets that I think is doing a good job here. And the interesting thing about a lot of these cyber AI companies is they have kind of an embedded network effect or an embedded data advantage, and that, you know, companies are incentivized to share their threat intel into a network with other companies because then they get that data back. And so for a company like a CrowdStrike, you know, if Bank A sees a threat signature, they share that data with Bank B so that when that threat hits Bank B, they're already prepared for it, and they're able to kind of instantaneously block it. And so I think that CrowdStrike's a great company in that context. You know, and there are a number of others, but that's kind of how I see the breakdown is the old companies that are transforming mostly through acquisition, and the new companies who are built ground up for AI.
Mm-hmm. Does CrowdStrike, like, are they targeting more like larger enterprises, or are they like, what's their kind of strategy, and what kind of security services are they providing for, you know, their companies?
Yeah. So they're kind of going full stack. You know, they're selling into the enterprise, and they're kind of moving down market as well. You know, they're selling, historically they've been selling like endpoint security. Every security company, it's a very interesting industry in that every security company is basically trying to build a portfolio of security products. And so they all start with one kind of niche product. So CrowdStrike endpoint security. You know, others started with other kind of niche security products. Some started with email security. And from there, they try to build a product portfolio of, you know, okay, endpoint security, and then, you know, access governance, and then behavioral analytics, and then threat intelligence. And so CrowdStrike's doing the same thing. They're using that playbook to try to build out a portfolio of different products that have kind of AI embedded at the core.
Interesting. So one of the companies that has kind of gained popularity with retail investors is Palantir. And I wanted to get your kind of take on Palantir. What kind of do you, how do you assess kind of Palantir's, you know, unique product kind of value proposition, their competitive moat, you know, their future? What is kind of, you know, their bigger picture, you know, trajectory, and how do you evaluate that company?
Yeah, it's funny. I think Palantir is one of the, at least initially, was misunderstood. I think most people thought, and some people still think, that Palantir is a services company. I think that's fundamentally untrue. If you look at their financials, they don't have the sort of margins of a services company. But I think what Palantir is they have a really powerful sort of data and AI platform at their core. And then they have, you know, they have really smart people, forward deployed engineers, who basically go into a company, integrate their data streams, and then help unlock value from that platform. And I think that, you know, Palantir is interesting to me for two reasons. I think one is they're selling a solution, and they're selling from the top down. And so they'll go to the CEO of an oil company or the CEO of a bank, and they'll say, hey, what are your highest priority issues or problems to solve for the year? And they will basically sell in a solution which involves, you know, primarily that licensing of that data platform, but then all the services that are required to make that a reality. And I think the second reason why it's interesting, if you think about kind of the dynamics that we discussed in the first episode of AI within, you know, legacy companies, AI inside of non-founder-led companies, it's really hard. And it's hard for a number of reasons. One reason being it's hard to attract talent. And so if you're a big bank or you're a big oil company or you're a government agency, you're competing with Google and you're competing with Facebook and you're competing with all of these great companies to try to acquire talent, to try to hire away the great data scientists and the great AI engineers. And it's hard for you to compete. A CEO of a bank, because of the incentive structure, because of the organization, because of all the political challenges, they can't just go pay, you know, recent PhD graduates from MIT million dollar salaries and give them the freedom to work on whatever they want. And they know that. You know, I've had conversations with executives at some of these big companies, and they understand that. And so they see a company like Palantir as a solution to that problem. They basically say, okay, well, I can't hire away all those PhDs from MIT, and I can't pay them $1 million salary, but, you know, I can take, I can take sort of an allocation of my budget, take, say, $5, $10 million, and I can pay Palantir to deliver something that, you know, is similar, that would otherwise be created by all these PhDs I would hire. And so, you know, I think that's kind of the dynamic that's at play here. I think that executives at old world companies, executives at large companies, you know, officials within government agencies see Palantir as a way to embrace their data assets, as a way to leverage AI, as a way to sort of improve the efficiency and unlock knowledge locked within their system without the constraints that they would have of going out and trying to hire a bunch of smart people from MIT or Stanford or you know, Caltech to do it in-house.
Mm. I've got a ton of questions from Twitter followers when I asked about our interview regarding kind of potential industries that would benefit most from AI, let's say in the next 5 years. So Rick Berlin says, what industries will be the one using the most AI in the next 5 years? Stephen Mark Ryan says, areas AI will touch in the next 5 years that may surprise people. FinTwit Waterboy says, what is the most impactful industry AI could enter or disrupt in the future that no one is talking about yet? Attila Birchcheck says, what are some not so obvious industries does Will think that will be disrupted by AI? And Josh Fuller says, what industries and companies outside of auto can leverage AI to drive significant returns in the next 2 years? So that's just a sampling. There's dozens of questions in a similar line, kind of like, okay, so there are some more obvious industries that, you know, AI is disrupting. But are there some kind of maybe less obvious industries that you think, you know, are being disrupted, that are radically being transformed? Yeah, what are your thoughts kind of in the next, you know, 5 years or so?
Well, I think broadly speaking, every industry will in the future depend on AI. And I think that the reasons will be different. But I think generally speaking, like a low-level application of AI that we can talk through a couple examples is process automation. You know, every single company and every single industry has mundane processes that humans don't want to do, that's inefficient for humans to do. And that's sort of low-level application of AI that can be done here and now today. And I think that's true across every company and every industry, whether that's, you know, automating sort of customer service issues or automating document review or automating accounting functions. That's broad horizontal across all industries. And I think, you know, talking through a couple specific kind of vertical applications, take finance and biotech drug discovery. So in finance, you know, there are a ton of different ways to use AI. I think one of the ones that's really interesting is loan decisioning. And so deciding whether or not to give somebody a loan and how much to loan them and what interest rate to loan it to them at. And, you know, traditionally this was done with a kind of rule-based underwriting model that was created by an actuary. And it looks at, you know, your FICO score, which is also a rule-based kind of legacy actuarial model, looks at your income, looks at some other factors, and it spits an output. And companies have started to realize that, you know, the circumstances are different for every person. And this kind of monolithic model of just using an actuarial table and rule-based model isn't the most effective. And in fact, you know, you can use AI to do two things. You can use AI to both reduce your risk and so actually have lower loan default rate while simultaneously approving more people. And I think that that's a great application of AI, and there's some really interesting companies doing that. And there's an interesting dynamic here in that, you know, there are companies who are selling to banks, legacy banks, to you know, selling their algorithms essentially to legacy banks. And then there's an entirely different subset of companies, fintech startups, at this point, some public fintech companies, who are basically just replacing banks and becoming, you know, sort of a next generation bank using their own AI models to make lending decisions. So I think that's a simple application within finance.
With finance, if you don't mind me jumping sure. in. What are some of these like companies that are using AI in fintech? And if you notice, you noted like loan processing would be one aspect. Are companies like Square, are they using much AI in kind of their overall processes? And if so, kind of for what?
Yeah. I would imagine, you know, any modern company, especially a company like Square, would be using AI for loan decisioning, for fraud detection. I'll give one example of a company. This is a private company called Petal. And they basically build, it's a credit card company, kind of next generation credit card company. And what they found is there's a sort of a subset of the population who are considered traditionally subprime. They have credit scores of, you know, 500 or 520 to say 620. And a lot of them are recent college graduates. And it's just that they don't have, you know, they graduated college and they've got their student loans and they don't have, you know, they probably have a maxed out credit card that they used in college. And they don't have a long credit history, but they just got a new job. And so the traditional sort of traditional finance companies, the traditional banks would look at that and say, oh, well, credit score is 550 or 580 or 610. They're subprime. And, you know, we're either going to give them a, you know, $500 credit limit at a 30% APR, or we're not going to give them a limit at all. We're just going to decline them. And they basically built a model using AI and said, well, actually, you know, if we look at a bunch of other factors, we can underwrite them. And in fact, it's actually a good population to underwrite, relatively low default rates. And instead of giving them a $500 limit, we can give them a $5,000 or $10,000 limit. And so that attracted new customers, and they could do that at a lower interest rate. So that's one company that's kind of doing this on their own, and has been very successful so far.
Mm-hmm. Besides fintech, are there any other industries that you think? I mean, it feels like the question also is broad because, you know, as you're saying, like all industries are going to feel the impact of AI in different ways because, you know, everything is going to get, you know, it's not just like, it feels like it's not just one technology, but it's such a pervasive technology where, as you're saying, processes, things will get more efficient. There's a whole economy of thousands, hundreds of thousands of companies that will provide, you know, services to existing companies using AI to make things more efficient. And so it seems like everything will get supercharged, but are there, what other type of maybe outsized kind of unique, I don't know, industries might be transformed by AI?
So one that's interesting, and this is something that's somewhat new to me, is genomics and biotech. And over the course of the last couple of weeks, I've had conversations with a number of biotech companies and executives in the space. And it's really interesting to me to apply AI to those problems. And essentially the challenge there that you can solve with AI is basically the process of drug discovery is you start with a ton of combinations, hundreds of thousands of possible combinations. And it's a process of elimination to try to find, you know, narrow it down to one solution that, you know, solves the problem you're trying to solve with the least amount of side effects possible. And sometimes you start with hundreds of thousands and you end up at zero. But the process of going from hundreds of thousands to one or to zero is pretty long and it's pretty complicated. And it's manual and there's some, you know, really, really heavy compute work that's done. And it's not very efficient. And the promise of AI is that AI can massively shorten that drug development pipeline. And so you could start with, you know, you basically go into a system and you say, hey, here's the problem I want to solve. You know, here are the symptoms I'm willing or minimize symptoms. And it will basically come up with a few different compounds that you can validate. And so you've all of a sudden gone from this, you know, multi-year, super expensive drug development pipeline down to something that you can do, you know, in a matter of an AI system that can compute that in a matter of hours or days. And along those same lines, I think another interesting thing is discovering sort of, you know, proteins or enzymes and discovering different combinations and manipulations and mutations. You know, traditionally, if you wanted to do that, you would have to do really extensive manual testing. It would take, you know, months and months or years and years. You'd have to literally have a lab with petri dishes and grow things in petri dishes and then do sort of, you know, do an analysis of the petri dishes. And it's incredibly complicated, kind of convoluted. Whereas with AI, you can actually basically predict like what a manipulation would do or what it would look like after it came out of the petri dish. And so instead of doing all this manual labor and having, you know, humans in a lab with lab coats and petri dishes, you could just have a software program that's able to predict it with almost 100% accuracy. And then you just validate that output in the lab. And so that's an area and that's an application where I think there is huge cost savings in the short term. And I think there's massive societal benefit on the long tail, because if that drug to development cost goes down, then the cost of the drug goes down. That's good for society. And we'll discover more cures and more drugs than we would if we were just using the traditional system that we've been using for the last 20 years. So that's an area and application that I think is extremely exciting and one that I think is underappreciated.
With biotech, so like I had a person like, you know, pitch me a biotech company this morning and it seemed interesting. But one of the questions I had this morning, I was like, it seems like the intersection of biotech and like and genomics and also AI is going to unleash just like a crazy era of innovation, because if you stick AI to, you know, really figure out like, because a lot of past biotech stuff is like kind of like, it seems like it's like kind of guesswork, you know, it's like trial and error, it's just like happens, right? And it seems like AI is just prime for that, you know, like the AI is just like meant to do that type of stuff. And I wonder, are existing biotech companies like in the position and the place to really, you know, bring on that AI expertise and, you know, be big winners? Or do you think there needs to be, or there are, you know, kind of new AI biotech companies that are fundamentally approaching the problems of biotech differently, you know, through a lens of AI, and will they have an advantage? Like, how do you, you know, look at those, that type of conflict or that type of tension between the existing biotech companies who are, you know, trying to incorporate AI versus, let's say, potentially just starting from scratch, like, or just having an AI first biotech company?
Yeah, there are three thoughts here. I think the first is that a lot of these sort of programs are run as partnerships between a much larger company and a smaller company that's more research oriented. And I think that that's probably going to be the case for a little while, maybe for forever. And I have two colleagues, Simon and Ali, who are both experts in this. And, you know, one of them was doing cancer research before joining ARC, and they can dive much deeper than I can here. The second thought is, you know, I think there are a couple companies that are building kind of horizontal platforms to do drug development and sort of biotech using AI. Think of it as like an AI for biotech, or sorry, AWS for biotech, where they have data assets and they have the sort of lab equipment, they have the AI algorithms, and you can come on and basically say, hey, here's what I want to do. You know, here's what I want the output to be. Figure out what the input is. And they will go out and do that and take a royalty or equity in your company in exchange for doing that. The third piece that I think is really important here, probably underappreciated, is the data assets. And so, you know, the more data you have, there is publicly available data sets of, you know, different proteins and enzymes and all of that. And that's great. But I think what's really important here is looking at the data assets that a company has, a biotech company has. So if a company has been around for 10 years and they've been collecting tremendous amounts of data, then they're sort of at an advantage to build the neural networks and build the models, you know, that can do that discovery, drug discovery, that can kind of automate that guesswork. Whereas if you're starting from zero, or you're starting from just the publicly available data set, you're probably starting from behind the ball.
Mm-hmm. A Twitter follower, Will Real, says, how did you get started in artificial intelligence? I also had some questions on this of, you know, does AI, machine learning, all this stuff, neural nets, does it differ a lot in terms of like, I mean, for example, you know, back in the day, 10, 20 years ago, you could, you know, 20 years ago, you jump on, you know, a computer, you learn HTML and you pump out a website and then you move from there into some little more advanced stuff. And then, you know, 10 years ago, you adopt, you know, different frameworks to come up with a web app and, you know, with more features. And it seems like now with AI, right now, the barrier to entry in terms of the knowledge and expertise you have to have seems quite high. It's like, it doesn't seem like, you know, junior high kids are jumping into AI, you know, programming right now. Like, how do you see this unfolding in the future? Do you see it where, you know, it's a concentration of AI expertise in terms of companies where it's like you have the best of the best, just, you know, really concentrated, kind of like what we have today with social media and some search and some big, you know, internet media companies. And do you see regular folks, even hobbyists, just accessing AI through different APIs that, you know, companies open up? And this goes back to this question, is how did you get started with artificial intelligence? Like, is it something that, you know, is achievable in terms of, you know, or is it really something that is kind of for the top, you know, 1% or 0.1% of developers or, you know, young people out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to answer the first question, I got into AI by accident because I wanted to solve a problem with technology. And it just so happened that AI was the best way to solve that problem. And that was the behavioral analytics, looking at you know, how users type and all of that. That it just so happened that was kind of a natural problem to apply neural networks and machine learning to. And I was very fortunate. My co-founder was an expert in AI, and he had published research from college and sort of classifying like coral reefs using neural networks and doing some really, really interesting stuff. So I was able to lean on him and learn quickly through him. But, you know, AI fundamentally at the core is just math. Neural networks are just math. And it's really just kind of mostly linear algebra. And so, you know, I think it's a little bit different than traditional computer science in that, you know, the people who are able to most sort of effectively or efficiently transfer to AI research are those with a strong applied math background. So if you majored in math or, you know, you just happen to love math and you watch YouTube videos on linear algebra for fun, you're probably better positioned to transfer to AI research than somebody, you know, who's just a pure software engineer. And so I think that's one thought. I think that, you know, as we think about kind of how this is going to evolve, I think it's going to look a lot like software. You know, software originally was hard to use. Like assembly language was very complex. You had to be, you know, an expert in assembly language to write a very, very simple application. And now, you know, you can, anybody who's 12 years old with a computer can learn how to build an app or build a website using tools online for free. And the barrier to entry has become very, very low. And so I think that we're going to see the same thing with AI. Right now, you know, building AI models is somewhat complex. It's gotten a lot simpler over the last few years with kind of open source projects and with you know, developer technologies and developer tools. But it's still pretty complex, and you know, it's still hard for it'd be hard for a 12-year-old just to start building neural networks for fun. But I don't think that really matters. I think if you think about this in the long term, what's probably going to happen is it's going to look like software, where you're going to have, you know, people who are really good at what they do, really smart experts who are building kind of these core capabilities, and then kind of releasing those core capabilities or making them available through APIs or through other interfaces. And then anybody, you know, who has access to a computer and wants to put in the time and the effort can figure out how to interact with those core models using APIs and just kind of traditional code. And so, you know, I think a parallel here is like, you know, if you think about, you know, think about any sort of software that you use, building an app, for an example, if you wanted to actually code everything from sort of the chip all the way up to the user interface, like it would take you forever. And you would have to be an expert engineer to build that. But you don't need to do all that. Like Apple did a lot of that work, right? Apple figures out how to compile everything, and they manage all the widgets and present all the colors. And all you have to do is kind of figure out how you want to lay everything out and build some functions into it. So in the future, if you want to build an object recognition system or use GPT-3 to do, you know, build a chatbot, you know, OpenAI is building kind of the core of that. They're doing all the complex stuff and all the math you need to do to make a neural network work. And if you want to build an application on top of that, you don't need to know anything about machine learning or AI. You just need to know basic JavaScript skills. And if you have that, you can build a chatbot on top of GPT-3. And so I think that's probably how the future is going to look. We're going to have a concentration of companies who are building kind of these core capabilities who are very, very valuable and have an advantage. But then we're also going to see a lot of other companies and applications built on top of those platforms who are also valuable and also build really cool, valuable things.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, that everything will be filled out in a sense, you know, where from the top, the hardest problems be solved, but also making it accessible to build. Because we're talking about, like, I don't know, what it feels like, it feels like the capabilities of what machine learning, AI, what neural nets can bring, it just feels like it could completely revolutionize, you know, programming, but just even value creation, you know, like how things are implemented in the world. But it just, that step is like all the steps in terms of making it accessible and democratic and having real value, like in an easy way, have yet to be fully fleshed out, because the core capabilities, the most innovative stuff is still just being discovered at this moment. It seems like over time, like we're going to have, you know, a crazy, you know, robust, dynamic environment where anyone, I wouldn't say anyone, but those who are coding, who are developing stuff are going to be pulling in just, you know, massive amounts of various AI related, you know, technologies, platforms, features, different sets to create interesting things of value. Is that kind of, yeah, what are your thoughts kind of on that, you know, future?
Yeah, totally. And I think another thing that's interesting here about AI is it's actually, there are certain applications that are building kind of a AI for coding. And so it actually makes building technology and applications even more accessible. And so with GPT-3, I was playing around with the API and figured out you could actually generate SQL code with a text command. And so I could go in and say, hey, you know, pull a list of all users who live in Chicago, who like cheese pizza, you know, who have been to Domino's in the last 3 days, assuming I'm Domino's and have all that data. And it will actually generate a line of SQL code to go and pull that data. And so without knowing any SQL, I could run a query against our databases if I were working at Domino's. And that's really interesting because that kind of represents this democratization of technology creation, where you don't actually, the skills you need to actually build valuable products, to build applications, build apps, build websites, is actually decreasing. Like without knowing any code, I think in just a few years, in some cases now, without knowing any code, you can create really interesting, really valuable products and services and push those out to the world. And I think that's interesting because it just lowers the barriers to entry. And so if you think that a problem should be solved, and if you have the desire to solve that problem, with very little knowledge, you could go out and you could create that product, and you could push it out to the world. And if it creates value for the world, you can create, you know, wealth for yourself and wealth for others. And I think that to me is super exciting. And that's just sort of an example of how I think AI will enable humans to be more productive and create more value for the world.
Yeah. Interesting side story. So I have a 6-year-old son, and he's like, it's weird, he's like dying to create all these apps. And so he's like designing apps all day, like hundreds of pieces of paper. And then he begs me every day, he's like, please help me make this app or these apps. And so I'm like looking at some, like, you know, platforms for kids to learn apps or coding, but then he doesn't know how to read yet, you know, or write. So I'm like, looking into no code platforms and options, and it's kind of interesting, like the progression of, it seems like where things are headed, where, yeah, I think, you know, there does seem to be this pathway of, and I'm not sure what the future will look like, but perhaps of no code in a sense where, if you know what you want, like you're saying, like, hey, pull Domino's pizza buyers from this zip code at this time, whatever, and make this. And like, it seems like if you know what you want, and it seems like some of that kind of complexity could be solved, you know, and it's already being solved by companies, but AI could come in and solve it even more. So it kind of, it's a different world, you know, I think probably in 5 or 10 years.
Exactly. Yeah, that's awesome. That was that was me as a kid too. I was trying to figure out how to build apps and games, and it's a great way to learn. And I agree. I mean, look, I think that you shouldn't need to know Objective-C to build valuable products for the world. And if we can remove that barrier, then we can, you know, allow people to create cool products without that, you know, sort of unique skill or knowledge base. I think that's great. I think that that's the promise of AI. And, you know, just to give another example of this, I think that, you know, in kind of AI and democratization, I think this is a huge misunderstanding. I think people think that there's a narrative that AI is going to create huge amount of wealth for a very small number of people, and everybody else will be kind of will be left to the side. And that's just, in my opinion, that's fundamentally untrue. I think one, it's going to allow people to be more productive and leverage their knowledge and skills more effectively to produce more value for the world. And the example we just gave of somebody producing a digital product without any knowledge of how to code it. But I think it's also going to lower the cost of goods and lead to cost declines. And to give an example, going back and just quickly touching on robotaxis, the promise there is you know, not only are robotaxis probably going to be safer than human drivers, but they're going to be much, much less expensive. And, you know, we think that, like, if you model, this isn't our big ideas or annual report, but if you model the cost declines associated with electric vehicles and with sort of AI, you know, augmenting and replacing human labor in that context, the cost per mile for a rideshare will go down from, you know, I think it's $1.25 a mile right now or $1.50 a mile. It'll go down to about 25 cents a mile once autonomous is there with electric vehicles. And that makes transportation more accessible. And so, you know, for people who previously wanted to go from point A to point B, but couldn't because it was too expensive or had to go, you know, walk 5 miles and take a city bus, now they're going to have a clean, safe way to get from point A to point B for much, much less cost. And so I think that's overall, it's just broadly saying, I think the impact of AI in society will be very, very net positive.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there is going to be a painful transition period, though? Like, for example, let's say there is a rapid deployment of autonomous driving, truckers losing their jobs, you know, like maybe the productivity gains of AI have not yet been massively distributed or democratized yet. And there's some painful transition times where AI does seem to be kind of a force to kind of deal with or reckon with. And I'm guessing like the longer term you're saying like, hey, you know, the trends of productivity gains, the trends of cost declines, all of that stuff, it will be, you know, better for society. But how do you view kind of more the transition period?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's whenever there is a transition in society and the way that society operates, it's never super clean. It's always imperfect. You know, I will say that I think one of the great things about humans is that we're really good at adapting. We can adapt to changes. We can adapt to evolving circumstances. And that's why humans have thrived for so long. And I think that's why we'll continue to thrive. And so I think that will be the case. You know, it's hard to point to a specific example of like truckers is being one. You know, if trucking is automated, what will truckers do? They still need to earn an income, right? They still need to survive. And you know, I don't know what they will do right after that transition happens. My hope would be that they, you know, they can find other ways to use their knowledge base or their skills and generate value and hopefully generate even more value for the world. Whether that's, you know, going and building something else or working in a different sector. But I agree with you. It's certainly not going to be perfect. And computers weren't a perfect transition. You know, if you think about computers and the internet, you know, that certainly was a transition that wasn't 100% smooth. And Industrial Revolution wasn't smooth, and Agrarian Revolution wasn't smooth. But if you kind of zoom out and think about it over a you know, even a 10 or 15 year time horizon, I think it will be net positive for society, and it will be net positive for most people in society.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think about the wealth gap? Like, for example, you know, if you look at computers, internet, let's say the past 20 or 30 years, the promise of technology was, you know, all of society was supposed to benefit. Technology was supposed to be this wealth generator for everyone. But the reality was, for whatever reason, you know, there were certain people or classes of people or people tied to that innovation, whether it's employees of these companies, people who live near those companies, stockholders of these companies or assets around there, like, who benefited tremendously over the past, let's say, 20 years. But those who are, let's say, in rural America or some other place and, you know, weren't next to a tech company, who didn't own tech stock, who just, you know, like, there was this big discrepancy of who benefited, and you have a kind of a bigger worsening, you know, income wealth gap that's leading to, let's say, a polarization or tension in society. Does it, I mean, some people might say AI just exacerbates that. AI is just, you know, that tech on steroids. The rich will get richer in terms of those who are aligned with that technology, while those who aren't, you know, they will just stay, you know, displaced and largely alienated, right, from the benefits. Like, how do you view that? Do you have, like, a different kind of more optimistic perspective on what will happen?
Yeah, look, I mean, there certainly will be massive wealth creation. You know, our figure, our estimate is that AI can create $30 trillion in equity market caps over the next 15 to 20 years. And along with that, there will be, you know, some concentration of wealth. There will be, you know, people who are working at those companies, who founded those companies, who invested in those companies, will certainly, you know, get extremely wealthy from AI, or will likely get extremely wealthy from AI. I think that the interesting thing here, though, that's probably underappreciated is what we talked about a few minutes ago, which is how AI is going to enable people to create value, create products for the world without sort of the unique knowledge or skills that have historically been required. And so, you know, take building an app or a website or a SaaS company. You know, it used to be, you know, just a couple of years ago, and to some degree, even today, you have to have pretty specialized knowledge base, right? You have to, if you want to build an app, you know, you have to know how to code, right? Or you have to have the capital and the resources to find somebody who does know how to code and pay them to do it. And that's a barrier for a lot of people, right? If you live in a rural area and you don't know any engineers and you've never been exposed to software, like, you might have a great idea for a product that you want to create that can add value to the world. But the barrier for you at this moment is, like, you don't have the capital to hire somebody, and you don't have, you know, the skill set currently to build that software. And you could argue that, well, you can go online and you can find that skill set, acquire that skill set. But for some people, that's not, you know, that's not a path. That's not a possibility at the moment. And so for those people, you know, the promise of AI is that it would basically allow them to build a product, to build an app without knowing how to code. They can go into a no-code builder and they can do drag and drop and they can create an app. And if it creates value for the world, then, you know, they will also generate wealth for themselves and for everybody else around them that's involved in it. And so while there will be some concentration of, you know, people who are kind of own these core assets, core services, there will be huge wealth generation there. I think for society broadly, it does create more opportunity and lowers the barriers to entry when it comes to sort of creating products and services that do produce value for the world and give you leverage over your time and help you create wealth.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's actually that's really interesting, what you're saying, because in a way, like, I could resonate, like, there has been a technical barrier, you know, to create software. And really, if you're not really technical or you have that background and you haven't been able to, let's say, you know, get to a level of proficiency, then really that whole software world is kind of a little bit out of touch or, you know, out of reach for many people. But if AI can bring that kind of technical complexity down to a place where, you know, maybe not so technical people who have different skills, you know, more personal or more marketing, more just deliver value in different ways, right? They can have a greater access to the tools that technology provides. Combine that with, you know, Starlink internet, and you've got, like, you know, potentially, you know, a different world, you know, that is potentially more optimistic, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think broadly with technology, I think we're starting to turn a corner a little bit. You know, I think to give you an example, like think about, you know, Etsy as a shopping platform. Historically, you know, if you created goods or services, you know, my girlfriend has an Etsy shop for dog bandanas. And, you know, before Etsy, if she wanted to do that, she would basically be limited to selling it to the population in our town, or people that she knows, which is a relatively small number compared to everybody on the internet. Whereas with Etsy, you know, she can basically sell to anywhere in the world. She can advertise on Instagram, these social media platforms with huge reach. And so essentially she gets more leverage over her time. I think that's the ultimate sort of, that's the ultimate factor of wealth creation is leverage. You want to leverage, you want to get leverage over your time, over your resources. And fundamentally, technology gives people leverage. And so I think, you know, some of the platforms like Etsy have given people a little bit of leverage. I think AI will give people a huge amount of leverage over their time and over their knowledge.
Interesting. I mean, you add on kind of a globalized world where your market opportunity reaches perhaps the whole world, you know, and you add on, you know, the leverage of technology, and hopefully if it's less technical and more, you know, approachable. Fascinating stuff. Yeah, I need your help with another your idea. So there is this kind of a risk or danger. Let's say 5-10 years down the road, we've got, you know, really, really powerful AI that's, like, for example, like going back to our conversation with OpenAI, right now, I think it was, what, 175 billion parameters or something. Human mind has, what, 100 trillion synapses. So it's like it's inevitable, though, that, you know, this stuff is just growing like crazy, like the complexity and the ability of these neural nets and these models to eventually, you know, be comparable to the human brain and, you know, perhaps outpace the human brain. But in that light, right now you have some big tech companies that, you know, are investing large sums of resources to gather AI talent and to incorporate AI techniques, machine learning techniques into products and services. So for example, you have the Facebooks, you have the Googles, et cetera, but it's like their business models are largely centered around like more clicks, you know, more conversions. They're, in a way, this is my take, like they're hybrid companies. They're tech companies, but they're also like advertising companies, media/advertising companies. And so the business model is like, hey, advertisers pay a lot of money to reach certain customers, to get certain clicks, to get certain purchase intents and buy stuff. And, you know, it all is a flywheel. And it seems like if AI is will continually be invested in by these companies to get better and better and to be used in their products, it seems like what's the world we're headed to is like, hey, I'm watching a YouTube video and I get like an AI generated, you know, person who someone who I like just like instantly because the AI knows they're talking the exact way that I want them to talk. Like they like hits me in the right way. And they're using the exact grammar, the exact language, the exact topic, the exact angle, everything that is just like, I'm like mesmerized by whatever they're saying. And like I buy or I click whatever they're telling me to do. It's almost like this, like trance, you know, it's like AI has figured out the hack, the human brain hack, how to like deliver the perfect message to the human to do what, you know, the AI wants the human to do. It seems like that's like ultimately, I don't know. I mean, hopefully there's a different like detour. We don't get to that point, but I mean, can you help me out here? Like, how can we detour? Like, is this a concern for you? Or do you think fundamentally there would be things that interject and stop that, you know, progression?
Yeah, no, it's a real concern. Honestly, I think that if you think about social media now and the advertising model, it's certainly very effective at capturing people's attention and maximizing the amount of time that you spend on a specific service. I think there are kind of three things that are interesting here, or probably hopefully will prevent that ultimate reality from becoming true. I think one is the consumer sentiment has shifted in the last couple of years. And it's much more privacy oriented. People are much more aware that that's happening. And I think that people are starting to value goods and services that promote privacy and you know, clearly don't manipulate them. And so I think consumer sentiment is shifting. I think that's a positive. I think second, you know, the smartest people that I know, the best people in AI, they don't want to work on those problems, right? They don't want to work on advertising optimization. One, because it doesn't create any value for the world. And two, just frankly, they want to work on harder problems. You know, they want to work on working, you know, solving the drug discovery challenges and shortening that pipeline and curing cancer, or they want to go work on real world full self-driving. They want to work on these really big problems that are hard and that provide value to society. And so it's kind of a joke within the tech world to a degree of like, oh, like, you know, I'm kind of done working on optimizing ad clicks or getting somebody to look at something for half a second. I want to go work on something more meaningful. And so I think fundamentally to create these technologies, you need the human capital. You need the smart people to build them. And I think that that's shifting a little bit. The smartest people that I know are shifting away from you know, those types of products and services and you know, working on kind of bigger problems that need to be addressed in the real world that will provide more value to society. So that's promising. I think third is, you know, ultimately, whether it's good or bad, and that's a totally separate debate, I think we are going to have regulation. Like there will be regulation related to, you know, related to privacy, related to AI, related to social media. And I think that will, you know, that will certainly have an impact on what the future of that world looks like.
Mm-hmm. Long Elon says, how long before we reach true artificial general intelligence with intelligence comparable to humans? And Jeffermans on Twitter says, ways of increasing odds for positive AGI. Yeah, so actually, this is taking another step. Yeah, actually, on the whole ad thing, I mean, it does seem like, yeah, if there is regulation, more values for privacy, and a recognition of people, you know, wanting to work on better things, like, this do seem like to give, you know, a lot of optimism. You know, it seems like there is a battle playing out though of how all of this will play out exactly. You know, there will probably be bad actors too, you know, like some companies or some.
And, oh, for sure.
And yeah. But with artificial general intelligence, what's your take? Do you have any, do you think, you know, we're going to reach this anytime in like 10 or 15 years? And are you more optimistic or do you have a ton of concerns?
Well, 50 years, I would say yes, certainly. Between now and 50 years, I think it's hard to predict. And I think that, you know, anybody who is an expert in this would just basically be giving you a guess if they said it was, you know, 8 years versus 14 years. I think that the thing, my perspective is it doesn't really matter. I don't think we need artificial general intelligence to unlock a lot of the value of artificial intelligence. I think we need, you know, AI models that are general enough to be applied broadly, like GPT-3, but specific enough to focus on, you know, a specific sort of data set or problem set, like a language model. And so if you have a general language model like GPT-3, once we get to GPT 4, 5, 6, that will unlock a tremendous amount of value. And it will do so without knowing how to drive a car. And so I think that, you know, and similarly, you have, you know, full self-driving and you have an AI system that's designed to do that. That's creating a lot of value for the world. It doesn't need to know how to have a chat with a customer service rep. And so I think, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see these systems that are general enough to be applied broadly to a number of different use cases or tasks, but specific enough to focus on kind of a specific medium like language or audio or video, or kind of a macro set of problems like conversation. And so I see that as being real in the next 5 or 10 years. But when it comes to artificial general intelligence and having a system that is, you know, superior to the human, you know, in multiple different sort of languages and mediums, I think we're still a ways away from that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Attila Berkcheck says, what are the best resources for learning about AI? I'm curious, like, how do you keep up with the field? Are there any great Twitter accounts? Are there any great websites, any great YouTube channels to follow? Any, like, you know, like, how do you just, because everything's changing so fast. There's so many things happening.
Yeah. So OpenAI's blog is fantastic. And I think that's something people should check out. It's high level enough where you don't have to be an expert to understand it, but then they link to papers if you want to really dive deeper. DeepMind also publishes some great content, both videos and blogs. Lex Friedman is a great resource. He's a thought leader in the space. And love his Twitter account. He has some great videos. Other than that, if you Google or look on Twitter at kind of Lex and the people that he retweets, I'm trying to retweet more people who I find fascinating in the field, who break down AI. So I'll certainly continue to do that. But I think it's a good starting point.
Okay, fantastic. And then I got a bunch of questions from people asking, like, John Marshall Mantel says, how did you get the ARC job? Mars Resident says, what does ARC look for in analysts? Some people were saying, like, how long will it take before AI does the stuff that you're able to do as an analyst? Just curious, whatever you can share, like, yeah, what's the background of kind of joining ARC and, you know, how did that happen? Just curious.
Yeah, so in terms of AI replacing me, it's funny. One of the things that analysts do is write a weekly newsletter that we email out. And I showed Kathy GPT-3, and her first question was, can GPT-3 write our newsletter? So it's not quite there, but it's certainly on the radar. I would say in terms of ARC, you know, I'll share my story. I was at Lyft and building product there, which was really interesting, working on a product at massive scale. But I wanted to do something a little bit more exciting, kind of focusing more on the future. And, I had a conversation with the analyst at ARG and reached out to him and talked to the team and talked to Kathy and had an opportunity to join and focus on AI. And I think what's really interesting and unique about ARG is how the organization's set up, kind of the DNA of the organization. You know, if you think about traditional finance firms, investment managers, there's a very kind of very typical career path, which is you go to an Ivy League school and then you go work somewhere, work in investment banking for 2 years, you get your MBA, and then you kind of work your way up into an analyst role. And the problem with that, and not to say those aren't smart people, they're clearly very smart people that work in those companies and organizations. But the problem with that is you have groupthink and you're trained to think about the world in a very specific way. And typically those organizations, instead of structure optimized, to sort of optimize returns on a quarterly or annual basis. And so the way you think about the world, the way you think about companies is very much optimized in that mindset. Whereas ARC is a long-term investor, right? We build 5-year price targets and we're very much interested in the future and what the world's going to look like 5 and 10 years from now. And then what companies will benefit most from that. And so ARC tends to hire people who are not from the traditional financial world, but who have more specific domain knowledge and think differently than most traditional financial analysts would. So as I mentioned, one of our genomics analysts was a cancer researcher before joining ARC. And so she has a very, very interesting perspective on the world and on drug discovery and biotech that a lot of traditional financial analysts wouldn't have. Similarly, like I spent time building a startup in the AI space, and so kind of got to deploy this technology in the real world and meet with big banks and big healthcare companies and see how they're thinking about AI. And then got to build products at scale at Lyft and really understand the inner workings of a big tech company and how incentive structures play out and how they think about technology and what's cutting edge there. And so, I approached problems from a totally different perspective than a traditional financial analyst would. I think that's true across all of ARC. But that's kind of the story of how I joined. And, and it's certainly a great place to work. And it's obviously growing. We're over 30 people now, but it's very much a startup culture. It moves very, very quickly. Flat organization. So all the analysts talk to Kathy every day. And we're constantly going back and forth on ideas. And I think another thing that's interesting too, just worth mentioning is kind of the cross collaboration. And I think traditional investment firms are set up such that an analyst focuses on a very specific, subsector. And so, a traditional firm would have an analyst who focuses on automotive and they cover GM and Ford and that's it. And so, they don't know how to think about Tesla. They don't know how to value Tesla. Whereas at ARC, the analysts focus on technology platforms. So I'm focusing on AI. We have an analyst that focuses on energy storage systems. We have an analyst that focuses on autonomous systems. And so we can all come together and think about Tesla, from sort of first principles. And so I can think about it in the context of AI and sort of AI system design. The energy storage analyst can think about it in terms of battery capacity and what the technology looks like there and really approach it kind of from the ground up with first principles as technology platforms rather than just as a sector. And I think that's very unique to ARC as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It's fascinating. The approach of ARC Invest just seems to be like fundamentally different than a traditional finance or Wall Street. Like, you guys are really being a meritocracy, taking some of the best, most capable people in different fields, bringing them their knowledge together to get the most cutting edge and the real accurate information in these fast changing industries, right? And I think so ARK Invest, you guys have this five platforms of disruptive innovation. Number one, DNA sequencing. Number two, energy storage. Number three, robotics. Number four, artificial intelligence. Number five, blockchain. And then I think you guys have 15 technologies on top of those five platforms that Kathy and Brett have been talking about for a while. When I listen to that, I'm all on board, you know, with the platforms, technologies. It just seems to me artificial intelligence is like, it's got to be the big one. I mean, do you disagree with that, or what are your thoughts? It just seems it's the technology that'll infiltrate all of those other, you know, platforms and technologies. It just seems like the mother of all of them. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm certainly biased, but I think that's the case. I think if we think about the world and, you know, in a 10, 15 year time horizon, I think AI will be the greatest source of wealth creation in human history, in my opinion. And I think that's certainly, certainly going to be the case here in the next 10 to 15 to 20 years. The thing about AI that's interesting to me is that it's horizontal. It cuts across every industry, cuts across every application of technology. And I think that's certainly the case. And as I said earlier, you know, we believe that AI will create $30 trillion in value over the next 15 to 20 years compared to the $13 trillion in value that the internet created. So yeah, hugely bullish on AI. I will say in the short term, you know, I'm excited about genomics and biotechnology. I think that we're sort of reaching a point of inflection in terms of drug discovery and genomics that's fascinating. And we have two analysts that cover that. And they certainly have their work cut out for them over the next couple of years as the space changes very quickly and evolves. But I agree. I think AI is certainly a technology platform to watch.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for extending and being gracious with your time and knowledge, sharing with me and all of the viewers here. It's been a super helpful, beneficial, interesting conversation, especially with AI, technology, the future, so many interesting things. And I'll go ahead and link your Twitter profile in the video description below so people can follow you. Some really interesting thoughts that you're sharing on Twitter. Do you have anything else where people can follow you, or any kind of last thoughts or ideas that you wanted to share with the audience?
No, I really appreciate it being here. I'd say on the Twitter, I'll try to keep people up to date. Also check out ARK Research. If you go to ark-invest.com, we have links to all of our white papers and our big ideas from last year. There's a ton of great content in there about artificial intelligence, but about all the other technology platforms as well.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks a lot. And we'll talk to you later.
Awesome. Thanks, Dave. All right.